Derek Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt.
Hi, welcome back to Willing to Adapt. I am Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
How's it going?
I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm all right, yeah. It's the middle of summer now and trying to stay cool as much as possible.
All right, I hear you on that. Actually, we're sitting here with our iced coffees and cucumber water.
You're welcome. Today's a very different episode than what we usually do. We decided to branch out a little bit on this one. Do you want to let our listeners know, if they didn't read the title card, what this episode is?
Yes, today we're actually looking at an adaptation of two different movies, Scarface, which I'd be surprised if someone didn't know what movie that was. Even if you've never watched it, I think almost everyone has at least heard of it.
Or they've at least heard of, "Say hello to my little friend."
Exactly. The iconic clips, I think, have put it in the public consciousness.
Yeah, and it's been in a lot of the movies, too.
Yeah. So, and there is a book, actually, but we didn't read that.
There is, except very loosely inspired by it.
Correct.
Yes. The main one that people are familiar with is the 1983 film Scarface with Al Pacino. But most people, and myself included, did not know that it's actually based on a 1934 movie.
32.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. 1932 movie.
Which I actually did not know until you informed me of that.
Yep.
Yeah. But also, I will say, I had actually never seen the 1983 movie either.
So then, obviously, the answer to my question would be you watched it for the podcast.
Correct. Got it.
But you grew up in the ghetto.
So, yeah, surprisingly, okay. So I actually have,
like
most
cousins
of...
cousins and people who
And my cousins love this movie. Because I remember, so...
I've got cousins who love this movie, too.
I grew up not really watching a lot of anything violent. My parents kind of, you know, they didn't show us a lot of that type of stuff. And if I did watch certain movies, they were on channel, our KC, was it, what's channel 5? KTLA, and so our local stations, and they would always be edited. I think we talked about this in the past once, maybe even on for the podcast, on how there's certain movies we grew up with. And then when I finally saw the full movie, I was like, whoa. There was nudity and language in it, and I didn't know that because I watched the edited for TV versions.
Well, they probably had it heavily edited.
Oh yeah, for some of them, because I was thinking like Police Academy, those type of movies, comedies, and this one too was one in which, like, I'll be honest, I think outside of the more romanticized or the historical gangster stuff, I really didn't even like contemporary. Anything from the 80s and 90s gangster stuff, I've never really watched. If it's not, it was either The Godfather or older, pretty much. Like I was talking to my wife about it while we were watching the original, or the 32 movie. I grew up on like The Untouchables, Godfather 1. And then there were other like older movies or older TV shows that we would watch. That was pretty much about it. Anything that dealt with the 80s and the drug trade and stuff like that, I really didn't start watching some things off and on here and there until maybe really not until the late 2000s or like the last 10 years basically.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of movies that kind of glorify gangsters and violence and stuff like that. And I think, you know, after watching Scarface, I don't think it's glorifying it, but there's definitely a culture out there of people who don't see the cautionary tale and only look at the cool things that come from being...
I would agree, because like you said, growing up in the ghetto. No, growing up with where I did, my cousins were a little bit more traditional, stereotypical guys. And so I thought it was interesting one time after I first watched The Godfather and I brought it up to them, the responses ranged from, oh, it was boring, to I fell asleep. And it's not their favorite. They were more into Scarface or other things along those lines. And for me, I know it romanticized the mafia, but still, for what it was, it appealed to me when I watched it. We could talk about why, but it's I think it appeals to the different aspects of who we are as people.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get too much into that right off the bat.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there's this aspect of you play by your own rules, and you know, there's this romanticization of, you know, you do whatever you can to make it, and even if it means bending the laws or full on breaking them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think some people look at it as like a weird version of the American dream.
Yes, I think it's a version of the inverted version of the American dream based on what people see as necessity. And I think this, it's funny that we're doing this particular one-off podcast at the time we are. I think last week I saw a news article that had something along the effects of how the Gen Zers, they did a poll amongst Gen Z, and Gen Z found, they came back and they asked them, would you commit fraud or crime in order to move forward in life financially because of where we are, where the economy is? And I can't remember the exact percentage, but it was higher than 50% said that they would be more than willing to commit fraud because of how bad the economy is. Mm-hmm. And I think movies, when you look back when this movie was made in the 30s during Prohibition, I don't know what you read about it, but you know, we could talk mm-hmm. about that too, but just in regards to where society was and how I think I read somewhere how like adults watched it and didn't necessarily see something to be emulate, but young people did, or at least that's what they felt they were going to do.
Well, and I think there's always been people who are willing to do whatever it takes to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's always a different limit for different people and cultures, but even with a lot of behind the scenes stuff we get from Hollywood and like other successful people in different industries, like you hear about people who like flat out lie on their resumes,
yeah,
just to get jobs, or they pretend they're sick to get out of work so that they can go to like a job interview or to an event that'll help boost their career or something. And you know, for me, like I struggle with that because like honesty is a really big part of my life.
Yes.
And you know, like, you build trust with people and that mm-hmm. sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I personally could not do that.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, that I don't want to break that trust.
And no. Yeah. No. Like, I agree.
I would rather just be full honest with someone and say, hey, I would like to leave because of this or whatever. And I know that maybe I might not get what I want, mm-hmm. but you know, for me, it's more about that relationship or at least the trust that I've built, or you know, like, I don't want to ruin that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how much of it is also just because I know it's not a socioeconomic thing. I know definitely it's not that. I know people try to break it down into something like that, but I think it's in general, more just, I kind of wonder if it's more of a youth thing that is instilled in them.
I don't know. Well, I think at the very least, it's like a selfish thing.
It is. Because it recently came up in a conversation I had with my daughter. She's in AP classes, and she was telling me about how she knows how many people cheated in the class, in the final test. You know, and she was saying how they all did better than her. But I was very proud of her because she was like, she basically came out and said, I would rather be the lowest grade in the class, but do it honestly. And I know that is, when it comes to AP stuff and anything like that to get ahead, like you were saying, to get ahead, I know that is not just her generation. I know that happened back in my generation, mm-hmm. you know, back when we were in high school.
And it's hard because usually I think they get a push from something else, like somebody else or or friends mm-hmm. or whatever, you know,
or even the parents pushing them yeah. to be better.
Yeah, I know that there are people out there who like to say, you know, like especially in cases like with minority group or different things, different people, where they say, well, you know, they're just trying to compensate for whatever experiences or whatever opportunities they lack.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to a small extent, there is some truth to that, depending on scenarios. But I also, you know, I don't think it gives someone a full license to just
do whatever they
want to succeed. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of draws us into a little bit of the movies,
because
mm-hmm. the movies are very different from each other. They have the same plot.
They did, surprisingly. I was mm-hmm. at first I thought,
because I watched the first one first.
Oh, you did?
I did. Did you watch the 80s movie first?
I watched the 80s movie first, yeah.
See, you're not breaking precedence.
No, I'm not.
You know, I like to, unless I've seen the remake first, I like to watch the first one and then see how we got to the remake.
Yeah.
But I, Scarface was never a movie I wanted to watch, full honesty. And if I'm being very blunt, I don't think I would want to watch it again, but I can see why people like it. I get it. It's not my cup of tea, but it's cool. From a design standpoint and a script standpoint, I get it. It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle Pfeiffer's super young in it.
Yeah.
I didn't know she was in it. That was like one of her first movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I watched this movie for the both of them for the first time because... So I finally graduated from university.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, I should have started with that. But in my last semester, one of my classes, it was basically like a throwaway class just because I had to get a certain amount of units in a specific section, you know?
Hmm.
And I thought I was taking a history of Hollywood class. When I got there, it turned out to be history and Hollywood. That one word made a very big difference.
Yeah.
So it was about how Hollywood perceives history in its own movies.
Oh, okay.
And how it portrays it and how it's changed over time and how it will actually reflect on the cultures, but also will help influence the people who watch it.
Mm, okay.
And so a lot of times you're watching these movies that are set in different historical time periods, and more often than not, they're not that accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Even when they are relatively accurate, they're still supposed to be entertaining and they're still trying to make money, and so they're going to put things in there or take things away. And so it's an interesting study, like if you like history or you like analyzing things, like I guess we like to do that.
Yeah. True.
But... it was an easy class. Like, he had some very high standards, which I didn't quite get because I'm like, I don't understand like how I'm supposed to write this crazy amount of pages just for this one thing. But okay, he's like, can you give me more information, more details? I'm like, no. Anyway, so I watched this for one of the sections on that class.
Okay.
Yeah, there was definitely a bunch of movies that I watched for the first time because of that class, and one of them actually was The Godfather.
Oh, okay.
The Godfather was one of those movies that I never really had an interest in. I told people, like, if you want to watch it, like, I'll sit down and watch it with you, but I'm not going to just sit down and watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I watched it for class, and I was pleasantly surprised. I kind of liked it. It was pretty good. It was slow, but I liked it mm-hmm. enough. Again, I don't think it's a movie I'd come back to repeatedly or anything. Like, if somebody else really wanted to watch it, I'd probably sit down and watch it with them, but... It's definitely not a go-to, but
yeah.
But I like what they did, and I think some of the script writing is really good, and I think for the time, you know, it came out.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these movies are really, really big and popular, or they make the top 10 or 100 list because of like how they changed the course of filmmaking,
yeah.
and things like that. But all right, so do you want to try and give a very brief synopsis? Because you can give a synopsis for both movies, technically, if you give a really brief one.
I mean, a brief synopsis would essentially be an immigrant who, you know, starts in the underworld as a trying to make, not really make a name for himself, but basically is rising up in the ranks, becomes a right-hand man to a local crime boss, ends up whacking a former crime boss... Not former, another rival, which causes him to rise up even further to be almost the right-hand man. And then it moves on. He falls in love with the crime boss's girlfriend. That's right. And then from there, see how it continues. He has some. He continues to go further, and he pushes the boundaries with his boss basically getting angry at him for going too far and pushing boundaries to the point where he ends up whacking the only other major competitor, gets rid of them eventually after a couple attempts. Let me see what continues after that. And then eventually the crime boss gets jealous of him, tries to off the main guy, fails to do so. The main guy realizes what happens, goes after the crime boss, kills his boss. The one he's been working for, and he becomes in charge more or less, kind of more so in the 83 movie than less so in the 32. I'm skipping kind of a subplot with a sister.
But it's the same subplot in both.
The same plot, yeah, it is. It's a really weird subplot when you really get down to it.
Yeah.
Especially
in the 80s one.
Yeah, there's a kind of a. Let's just say he's uber protective to the point of where it comes across very.
The way that I looked at it was. she was like his attachment to innocence, and he didn't want her to lose her innocence or behave in a way that would take away from that innocence.
Did you read the connection though of how it was they took it from the Borgias?
No.
No? Okay. We'll talk about that a little later. I'm just finish the synopsis. And so
I mean, the 80s one was definitely a little weird.
Yeah. And so it basically gets to the point where and when we're talking about the 32, I saw the what I'm assuming is closer to the original cut, not the censored, the fully censored version where they changed the ending.
I don't know.
Because there's two endings to the 32 one.
But yeah. I don't know which version you watched.
I watched this one. I watched whatever was on Prime, which ended up being the uncensored ending. Okay. So the uncensored ending is very similar to the 83 one, where they basically there's some stuff he kind of so there, yeah, there's a thing going on with his sister. He ends up his best friend ends up or his like the person closest to him ends up with the sister. Excuse me. At the end, he thinks the sister ran off with a guy and that they're shacking up. Like, he gets angry, shows up, kills the best friend. And the sister was and the best friend were about to tell him that they just got married. He realizes the mistake, runs off. And the people after him in 83, it's South American gangs or Central American, I can't remember.
It's basically like the guy that he like
betrayed from down there with the drug trade.
He was like a big like drug lord.
And in the 32 movie, it's the cops. They surround the place. They kill all his people guarding him for both movies. And then he pretty much goes out in a, you know, after the sister is... How did she die in the 82 movie?
The 80... The 32?
No, 80.
83?
83 movie.
She was shot.
They shot her, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, as they were invading the house. That's right.
She, like, had that weird, like, come on to him moment.
Yeah. Where
she's like, what do you want from me?
And then in the other movie, the cops, it's a ricochet bullet that kills her. And then he kind of loses his...
Yeah, but it was almost like she was kind of trying to help him, like, defeat the cops almost.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, she was going to help him defeat the cops, but she gets a bullet ricochets and kills her. He kind of breaks down and goes out in a blaze of glory in both movies where he's just, no matter, you know, he's just shot to death. That's basically the end of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so all that rise to power ended in futility. Yep.
Well, we made it. We figured out the synopsis. All right, one thing I read on Screen Rant is whereas the 30s original was about how Prohibition created the mafia, the 1983 remake is about how the anti-drug laws created drug lords. And the 1980s movie is actually like twice as long as the original.
Yeah.
It's so long.
Oh, yeah.
And it's slow.
The 80 movies?
Yeah.
I actually got bored. I'm watching it. Like you said earlier, I understand why it appeals to people.
Yeah.
But I had a hard time getting through it. Mm-hmm. I was bored and like it just didn't really appeal to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, we said it's not our cup of tea, but.
Yeah.
All right. So the original 1932 film, Scarface, like we said, it was loosely inspired by a book. One of the other titles for it is Scarface, The Shame of the Nation.
Mm. Yeah. I saw that.
Yes, it was directed by Howard Hawks and produced by Hawks as well as Howard Hughes. And for anybody out there who doesn't know who Howard Hughes is, he was actually a really big name for the time. He was like a billionaire, and if you've seen the movie The Aviator, it's about him. Leonardo DiCaprio portrayed him in that film.
He also built the Spruce Goose.
He did, except a lot of people our age don't know that.
I know.
Yeah.
Watch Yogi Bear and the Spruce Goose.
Yeah, or have you seen The Rocketeer? He's portrayed.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I love that movie.
He got really big into aviation. He also was trying to make a bunch of movies in the 20s and 30s. He did a lot. Yeah, but he was a big name.
And one of the things is like the fact that he was creating a movie outside of the studios was a big deal back then.
Yes.
Because there was no independent film making. The studios held a monopoly. So for him to go out there, and he actually had a lot of problems because of that.
I'm sure. So the film, it's actually inspired by the gangster Al Capone, who, if you don't know Al Capone, he was a really big name for the time. He was actually still alive when the film came out. Yeah, so he ended up going and watching the film.
Yeah, they say he actually... So another thing I read, too, is that he sent two men to the writer's house in order to make sure that the movie was not a film about him.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's clearly inspired by him. There's enough about
him. They dropped enough little hints in there.
Yeah, but... And obviously, he's got a scar on his face. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I think for the safety of everybody involved.
Yeah, and in fact, I think they say that they're not even... Well, no, you said that he even saw the movie?
Yeah.
Okay. So another place I read said that Hawks, the director, mm-hmm. Came out and said that after Capone saw it, he loved it. However, it's unconfirmed because many think he just made that up in order for marketing purposes.
I mean, we never know, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, it was developed and was released during the pre-code era of Hollywood. And that is a very interesting subject. And we talked about that actually in my class. And I find it interesting. And if you look at how people look at the history of Hollywood and how they kind of over-glorify the golden age of Hollywood and stuff like that, it's interesting because the golden age of Hollywood, quote-unquote, takes place during the production code time, during like the Hays Code period.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't realize that they correlate. So before let me explain this. So the code system, essentially, it limited films on what they could portray. So a lot of films in like the 20s going into the 30s were portraying, I mean, for our standards, it's nothing almost, because we're just so overwhelmed with like gratuitous violence and sex and language now, especially with streaming. Mm-hmm. But back in the day when films were starting to come out, they kind of were just getting away with things. And it was just local codes that they'd have to abide by. So you could make a film and put whatever you want in it. But if like a county in New York decided, hey, we don't want to show that, like they might have to adjust the film and edit for it. And so it ended up costing a lot of money because they'd have to edit for different regions based on what each region wanted. But then there were also a lot of people who were starting to campaign against Hollywood films because of what was being shown in them. And there's a wide range. Like, obviously, like, you know, today's audience, some people might disagree with this, but a lot of people, especially the Catholic Church at the time, really campaigned having the production codes instituted. Mm-hmm. Because of a lot of the things that were being introduced in Hollywood films at the time, such as like abortion and sex and homosexuality and a long, long, long thing. I mean, some of them like, you know, interracial marriage and stuff like that. They were really trying to push back against Hollywood, and they were very unhappy with what was coming out at the time. And it's funny because when Hollywood started instituting the production codes, a lot of people call them the Hays Codes, they... actually started saving a lot of money because they didn't have to edit films for each region anymore. And so they were saving money on that because they would just make films according to a code that was nationwide. But then also, because the films were now more suggestive about things, like, you knew if a couple was gonna have sex, but
I also read that what they would do is they would actually put in these like really explicit, not explicit like sexually or anything like that, but explicitly anti-code scenes, so that the code editors would focus on that and miss everything else they threw that was more subtle. Mm-hmm. And so this way they would harp on the big scenes, get those edited out, and then they would miss the rest.
Yeah, but it was a lot of suggestive, more left to your imagination a little bit, whereas like, you know, if a man like led a woman into another room and then like closed the door, like it was a bedroom, like, you know, like you didn't have to see it to know what they were doing.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of things in the pre-code era that they couldn't get away with anymore. And this film was made right before they instituted those codes. And so what they had to do is they had to adjust the film for the codes, because the codes were not, they didn't allow for all the violence, and they viewed the original cut of the film as like over glorifying the gangsters. And
yeah, certain areas accepted it. I think in the original one, I read somewhere that like they aired it to a bunch of cops, cop organization, and they were fine with it. And like in the Midwest, it the states there didn't care much about the editing. But then they got to New York, and remember, New York and California were very different places back then. The New York code board felt they didn't like it. And he ended up going to court with New York in order to get the original ending played.
So if you watch the movie, when I was first watching it, I didn't understand all the aspects of the code and everything. But that's why when you watch the movie, it opens with a prologue that like kind of condemns all the gangsters and mm-hmm. stuff. And that's why there's a couple of random scenes like thrown in there.
Yeah, two big random scenes.
Yeah, where it's basically people talking about like, oh, how can all this be so bad? And why is all this happening? It's like, well, the power's in your hands. Like, you mm-hmm. can stop this. And,
so I actually read somewhere, too, that... So this is kind of getting a little more into the history behind it. So it did cause me to go into a little bit of Capone history. And it, like, granted, this is a historical take that I think it's a little bit... not embellished, but it's a little bit, the person kind of is looking for a cause and effect. And I don't know if it's fully there, but I think it's interesting to think about. But it correlates after I read that. And then I saw those two scenes, because like you said, the scenes were very, I think one is a publisher talking to someone from the government and a bunch of community leaders. And he's basically saying it's you, the government, and you, community leader, or you, the community, the public, who needs to stop these gangsters. And then the other one, I think, was a police chief talking to a bunch of a police detective talking to some of his officers about the how bad crime, you know, gangsters and idealizing them are. And it's very evident, the two, what I think they call them, the moralistic scenes that were added in. And so I read this one thing on Capone briefly where it said how many blamed the public for not pushing a cleanup of the cops and the judiciary system and the politicians to get rid of Capone. But the reason they did, yeah, they were afraid of them, but they needed their alcohol. And so as long as the alcohol was flowing in, they tolerated the gangsters. But as soon as Prohibition ended, then the public rose up and kicked the gangsters out. So like I said, it's not part of what we're going to talk about fully, but I think it correlates really interestingly with the messages that were in the movies versus what ended up happening in real life. You know, if you want to find out more, I'm sure there's plenty of books out there about it, but I thought that was an interesting connection.
Mm-hmm. I guess the original script had Tony's mother loving her son unconditionally, praising his lifestyle, and even accepting money and gifts from him. In addition, there was a politician who, despite campaigning against the gangsters on the podium, is shown partying with them after hours. The script ends with Tony staying in the building, unaffected by the tear gas and a multitude of bullets fired at him. After the building is set on fire, Tony's forced to exit, guns blazing, and he's sprayed with police gunfire, but appears unfazed. Upon noticing the police officer who had been arresting him throughout the film, he fires at him only to hear a single click noise, implying his gun is empty. He's killed after the police officer shoots him several times. A repeated clicking noise is heard on the soundtrack, implying he was attempting to fire while he was dying. So that's why I'm saying I think the version you watched is the same one I watched, where it is the alternative ending.
Correct. Not the
original. Because yeah. Under the code, whenever there is like a bad character, like a gangster or someone who takes the law into their own hands, or something like that, under the code, they didn't want to over-glorify those characters, and so they kind of wanted to show them having like some sort of comeuppance.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the ways they would do it is by portraying that character as a coward in the end.
Yes.
And so that's kind of what they did with Tony's character. Tony? It's Tony, right?
Tony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With Tony's character. They had him kind of falling apart in the end and like giving himself up over to the cops before trying to get away.
Mm-hmm. Did you read about the original... the alternative ending?
Not at length.
Okay. Yeah, so apparently the censors made them film an alternative ending, and the director refused to do so they hired another director to come in, and then the main actor was unavailable, so they had a stand-in, so you only see his head. But instead of him dying in a hail of glory, he surrenders to the cops. And then it ends with him like going to, they arrest him, he goes to court, the judge sentences him to death, and it ends with like a something like you basically see he's being hanged in the distance or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the alternative censored ending. So very different message at the end there, because mm-hmm. they were afraid, I think, that boys, young men, would see the going out in a blaze of glory as
right, yeah.
heroic.
Mm-hmm.
it tells you a lot about your interpretation of a movie if you see that as heroic,
though. Yeah, I think it tells more about the person watching the movie.
It does.
And their interpretation of it, because there are definitely people who, to this day, will glorify the remake of Scarface.
Mm-hmm.
I think it says a lot about your moral code and that sort of thing, because in both versions, his life kind of falls apart on him.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the 80s version, though.
Yes.
Like, he just makes mistakes in both versions that he wouldn't have made if he didn't live the lifestyle that he lived.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. One of the things I really like about the 1930s movie, it's a little cheesy, but I like it, is anytime somebody died on screen, like, you never actually saw them die.
Yeah.
But there'd be a big X on the screen. I thought it was kind of fun from, like, an artistic standpoint. But, you know, I mean, it appealed to a lot of people. A lot of people liked the movie. Critics didn't like it, but a lot of people who watched it really liked it. And, you know, clearly it was popular enough that they wanted to remake it.
Which they did.
It's funny that they say that Tony had, like, an incestuous desire for his sister.
So, okay.
Is that intentional, or is that just someone analyzing it?
No. So, that's the... Okay. Well, we'll get to that in the next one, because it's a lot more prevalent in the other one. And right. I was actually going to bring that up, because they do say that you actually get that in the book as well, that it's there. However, I think it could be interpreted in a couple of different ways. So,
sure. I mean, I didn't interpret it that way at all, but that's me.
All right. So we'll switch over to the next film. I think we're good on this one, outside of Boris Karloff being in it. I just wanted to mention that.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say something.
Yeah. I love Boris.
He was the narrator. In How the Grinch Looked
yep.
Christmas.
Yes, he was. Also known to many as from the movie Frankenstein. Not Frankenstein's Monster.
Yep.
All right, so on to the 1983.
I just wanted to say something real quick, though.
Sure.
About the Hollywood underneath the production codes.
Mm-hmm.
There is a big argument to be made out there, and people have made it, and I kind of like it.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, some people just don't like censorship at all.
Mm.
Like, some people are just like, no censorship. No censorship at all. Which, you know, maybe it's unpopular opinion, but I think there should be always some sort of censorship.
Mm.
I don't think, like, people should just say anything they want to. And in legally, you know, that's backed up by our laws too. Like, you can't just go into a theater and scream fire.
Yeah.
And then cause a panic.
Like, yeah.
We do believe in certain forms of censorship.
And I think also self-censorship can be creative.
Or wise.
Not just that, but I think it can be creative, because you think about how many movies, the classic movies, in a certain point of view, are self-censored because they portray things in a way that is not necessarily fully sexual or gory. They do it in a way that leaves a lot to the imagination,
mm-hmm.
and they utilize the sound effects or visualization. The more graphic a movie is, the more likely it's going to be a B-type movie. You know, it's going to be your horror movies or Quentin Tarantino. But it's never going to be a classic. I mean, maybe to some, but it's never going to be in the top 20 movies, you know?
But it's funny because you more look at, like, the golden age of Hollywood, how people call it that, you know? Mm-hmm. It's basically, like, the most of the 30s and then, like, into like the 50s,
mm-hmm.
essentially, is like the golden age of Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Some people ended a little earlier than that, but for the most part, the golden age of Hollywood's like the 30s and the 40s.
Yes, yeah.
But definitely by the 60s, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because it correlates with the institution and abandonment of the production codes.
Yeah.
And I would argue, and a lot of other people have, including my professor, and I'm not just saying this because he said it, because I disagree with him on many things, that it was the golden age of Hollywood because of the production codes.
Mm-hmm.
Because once movies were appealing to the masses and the morality mm-hmm. of them, of the time, like, people were actually more inclined to go see the movies.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, and so they were, and like, they were pushing those values and stuff. And even though there were definitely movies during that time that were, like, against morality and stuff, mm-hmm. they were portrayed in such a way that anybody could watch them.
Yes, I agree.
And I think it was more creative and artistic and subtle.
Yeah, because think about it. Like, when we think of classic movies, the majority of them are going to be from either the golden era, or they're going to be from the kind of maybe 80s on.
Mm-hmm.
But the 60s and 70s, I mean, there were some here and there, Star Wars.
I
but
find
for the most part,
after the code system went away, that movies that were kind of like landmarks for their time or have lasted the test of time were big because they were different, or they pushed the envelope or something like that. A lot of times people like certain movies because they were so avant-garde, or they were so against the status quo or something.
I agree.
And I get that. I'm not really a fan of that personally, because I'm much more driven by characters and plot and artistic like design and things like that. Like, and that's why, like, if you've seen older movies such as Mildred Pierce. You've seen Mildred Pierce?
I have not.
Oh, it's so good. Joan Crawford. Came out in, I think, early 40s.
Okay.
Something like that. It's definitely the 40s because she's got huge shoulder pads. She was known for those things. But but that movie, it's based off a book. In that movie alone, like, it deals with her, like, rise to, like, fame and fortune, essentially, because she, like, builds this business for herself. But she's, like, this almost like a pushover mom to her daughter. Her daughter's like so entitled and wants all this wealth and things.
Yeah.
And so she wants to give her daughter these things. And so she kind of does whatever she can to give her daughter these things.
Okay.
I'm probably going to give some stuff away here, but like she ends up like marrying this guy, like, and like, you know that she slept with him before marrying him and stuff. But, like, under the codes, like, they're very clever about it. Like, you know she's sleeping with him before marriage, but you don't see it. And then you end up finding out that after she marries him, you find out that her daughter is also sleeping with him. And, like, that's the reason why the guy married her, to get to the daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so he's, like, this major creep that only really married Mildred to get to her daughter. Yeah, and so, like, they handle it well. Like, you know what's happening, but you don't see it.
Yeah.
And so under the code system, you're still able to understand it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. Because I think it's...
I don't want to beat a dead horse.
Yeah, no. I think it's a... Yeah, we've kind of talked about it. But yeah, I agree with you on all that.
Yeah, but I say that especially because in this day and age with streaming and with, like, the way that Hollywood is going and even Disney now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like... Can we reel it back a little bit, you know?
Yeah. No. It's, in fact, it was funny because Twisters is coming out.
Yeah.
And I saw an interview with the director or the writer. I don't remember who it was. And they were kind of asking him, why did you not put a message in here? Because they were like, this is a perfect place to talk about climate change, you know? And his whole point was, no, I just want to write a movie. I want a movie that people are going to enjoy. You know, the movie does not have to have a deep message in order for you to see it. And I think a lot of the older movies and writers, they understood about how to get a message into something without being in your face.
Smacking you across the face with it, yeah.
Yeah. And they're often...
That's the problem with, like, woke culture in films now, is, like, there's no subtlety. I have no problem with people trying to, like, push an agenda or explain their opinion or something like that. But when there is no subtlety at all, that it's like you don't trust your audience or your listeners.
And I know
at
we've
all.
Talked about this before, but it's the same thing with all mediums.
Yeah.
Whenever the message trumps the art,
the art quality and
rarely is good.
Right.
And most of the books that I've brought up in the past that I dislike, that's what the case was. Or movies. You know, in fact, even a good movie or a decent movie for me is often marred when it has that one obligatory scene in it. And I'm like, really? It was a throwaway. It was pandering. All right, whatever.
There's an old Family Guy sketch. I don't remember how they get into it, but they say something about, I think, Winona Ryder.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I think it's making a comment about how bad she was in Age of Innocence or something, like the 90s movie.
Mm.
It's set in like the 1880s. It's like them on the set, and he's like, oh, my dear, I love you. I can't wait to whatever. And she looks at him, she's like, that is good. That is most good. And he's like, I'm sorry, I can't. She's terrible. He's like, I can't do this. And he's like, this is a horrible idea. Like, she's this, I don't want to be in this anymore. And he's like, is there even like a sex scene in this? And then you hear from off camera, yeah. You're like, oh, okay. Yeah, we got a film. Sometimes.
Yep.
But, yeah, I mean, I don't want to You know, I'm not trying to get on a pedestal or, you know, speak from a soapbox or something, but
yeah, no, but I think your sentiment I've heard from others who are in touch with art, the arts.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think there's a big pushback now in against a lot of major studios and other people who are just kind of done, like people who want more.
And that's why I've been hearing, like, lately movies have not been doing well because there's nothing good coming out.
I mean, look at, because this is the one I've been focusing on more, is like the last 8 movies Disney came out with, the only one that actually did well was Inside Out 2.
Yeah.
And that's because they actually focused on the characters and mm-hmm. the plot and the creativity, and they weren't pushing an agenda.
Yeah, yeah.
But all the other movies that they came out with, including all the remakes, mm-hmm. like they were pushing an agenda, and they were not true to the original source material, and they just didn't have a healthy respect for the audiences or the material.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah, but you know, maybe we're seeing a change.
Hopefully.
Yeah, there's definitely new studios popping up. And
yeah. No, we're seeing that in all, I think, all industries. Mm-hmm. And because I had a conversation with one of my in-laws recently, and it was about the gaming industry and how the gaming industry is failing. It's collapsing. And we were talking about whether indie is going to be the next wave because...
Indiana Jones?
No. The indie industry, indie gamers, only because indie publisher or producers... because the gaming industry is facing the same problems that you see at Disney and all the major studios. Sony recently, I mean, they put out games and they're so agenda driven that they fail, basically. But anyway, shall we talk about the next movie?
Yes, I think we should.
All right.
Next time on Willing to Adapt. So Scarface is also a 1983 American crime drama film, and it was directed by Brian De Palma. It was written by Oliver Stone and starring Al Pacino.
To me, it was amazing to see how similar they were.
Oh yeah, the structure, the skeleton is the same.
Yeah,
like all the main plot points are exactly the same. Mm-hmm. There's like a lot that they added into it, and they definitely updated it and modernized it. It's a story of a Cuban refugee, Tony Montana, who's played by Al Pacino. I was watching an interview with Michelle Pfeiffer. I think it was one of the anniversaries for the film, and they had I guess she was starving herself during the filming, just so that she could have that like cocaine addicted.
You know, that kind of makes sense in looking at how she looked in the film. Yeah.
The writer,
mm-hmm.
he based a lot of the experiences, especially with cocaine, on his own experiences because he was addicted to cocaine at the time.
Oh wow!
So when he was writing it, he was actually like taking cocaine. He was sniffing, wow. snorting it up, and so it kind of makes some sense because the movie's a little weird.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt.
Please like and subscribe. Maybe leave a review or just share us with friends and family.
We would also love if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromi@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.